right. Well, we're glad to have all of you folks here. Continue to pray for Sandy Toon as she's recovering from surgery, and a number of others, of course, as well. Brother Howard Sposato is still recovering from his surgery a couple, three weeks ago. But let's take a look now at our Constitution. I think we can make some good progress today. We've been studying the Church Constitution. You say, why in the world anybody want to study the Church Constitution? Well, why would anybody want to write one and not know what's in it? I guess that's my question. We have church constitutions for a couple of very important reasons. One of them is to help us understand why we say we believe what we believe. Okay? Now, notice how I phrased that. I did not say to help us know what we believe, but to help us understand why we say we believe what we believe. Okay? Why do we select the particular things to put in the two? There's a reason for that. Second thing is to help all of us understand our church philosophy and our approach to the ministry, especially in light of the fact that we're moving and we will probably have a number of visitors and people from the community who will be coming in to see who we are and what we're doing so that they can see if this is something they might like to be involved in. And so, at any rate, that's what we're doing. Now, we've been looking at leadership and government of the church. There are probably, in the Bible, allowances made for some variety within church government, okay? I don't think there's quite as much variety in the Bible as there is in practice, okay? But I don't think that we can rigidly say that there is only one way to come to decisions and do things, all right? And a lot of times the two big mistakes that we have been seeing that it's possible for us to make in churches that we are seeking to avoid is one, setting up a system where we have a dictatorial leadership on the part of one or more individuals. Okay? Now, the dictatorial leadership generally speaks of an out-of-balance authority in the pulpit. Fair enough? But there are other ways of having dictatorial leadership in the church as well. Sometimes you'll have a church where you have a pastor who is sort of like an employee. He's been there for a little while, and he's only going to be there for a little while. And he may not know that yet. But at any rate, he's just passing through. And then you have a few people in the church who are elected to office, but one, usually, or a few more people are in total control. They may use a variety of methods to make the decisions, but those are just external forms. Now, one of the biggest traps that we can fall into in thinking that we are avoiding dictatorship is to put together what is a strict majority rule. Now, I believe in congregational government, no question about it. That is absolutely biblical. But congregational government and majority rule are not necessarily the same thing. Are you with me? An awful lot of people think that if you have congregational government, that you therefore have to have a majority vote to do anything. The only problem is you can get a majority vote and you have 51% of the people be carnal, can't you? You can have a majority of the people out of fellowship with God. Anybody think of a congregation that's like that? Been reading about one in the Old Testament, haven't we? You know, here was Moses. How'd you like to have 2.5 million people in your church and all of them backslid but two? You know, that's what he had, wasn't it? Okay. Now, they had majority rule and they decided they didn't want to go in a promised land. So they spent 40 more years in the wilderness. They took a vote, you see. Isn't that right? And they put together a search committee. You know, they had 12 guys go into the promised land, and they came back, and two of them said, we can do it. And 10 of them said, we can't do it. You see? So the point is, there's plenty of evidence in the Bible to indicate that majorities are not necessarily the way to discern the will of God. On the other hand, a majority is not necessarily wrong either. Okay? What we're striving for here at Faith Baptist Church, and I think what every church should strive for, is some form of arriving at decisions where instead of just deciding what we're going to do, we have rather discerned what God wants us to do. Isn't that better? So if we can figure out what God wants us to do, well then let's do it and let's trust the Lord and let's press forward. You see? Now there are some situations where you just have to make a decision, okay? And I don't necessarily think we need to become mystical about all the different colors in the new building and those kinds of things. I think the Lord leads through people who have skill and ability, and we have assigned certain responsibilities to folks, and we'll just take that as from the Lord, right? And so I don't think we necessarily need to go into some long, drawn-out process of trying to figure out what particular shade of what particular color the Lord wants us to have in this particular nursery. You see? You just make a decision. And then if you make a mistake, then you fix it later. You see? There's some things that are like that in life. Some things I don't know that most people don't even think about those kinds of things unless they're afraid. You know, you decide, am I going to take this street or am I going to take that street? You have to decide that all the time in Greenville because there's 10 or 12 different ways to get everywhere. Isn't that right? And you don't come back the same way you go. Usually I go in a circle where I can make rights on red, you know, whichever way I go. Okay, I go this way when I'm going there and then I come back that way. But, you know, does the Lord have a will about those things? Well, sure He does. But on the other hand, we're not going to sit around and agonize and stop at every red light and block traffic praying about whether we should go straight or whether we should go right. You see, you make a decision, and then you make your decision right. You can't always make right decisions, but you can always make your decisions right. You know what that means? You can't always discern the perfect decision. A lot of people want to make decisions so that after the decision is made, they don't have any more responsibility. Well, you can't do that. You always have to accept responsibility for the decisions that you make. And when you make a decision, then you make it right. And if you find out you made a mistake, then you fix it. You see? And that's the way you proceed. You do the best you can and press on. Okay? Now, we've been talking about the various structures that we've put into place in order to accomplish those kinds of things. And we have seen how that works in calling and dismissing the pastor and the responsibility of the deacons and what their job is. And then we've looked at the other offices. Now, this section, on page 4, where it talks about concerning a church clerk, treasurer, trustees, business meetings of the church, and so on. That's what we're going to look at today. We're going to get through that real quickly because most of this is practical, technical stuff that we have because we are not only a local church, but we're also a corporation in the state of South Carolina. We own property. The reason you incorporate is because then the corporation has the privilege of functioning like an individual. Now, what does that mean? That means that somebody can sign in the name of the corporation. The corporation can own property. Now, how can a corporation own property? Corporations, you know, what is this church anyway? Is the church where we meet? No, that's a building. The church is the body. It's a spiritual organism. But in order to conduct business, pay bills, own property, and things like that, we also have to be a physical organization. And so the corporation is the physical organization. And these things talk about this. I think I mentioned this to you last Sunday night. Sunday afternoon last week, after we talked about these things, I got home and had a fella call me, and boy, they were just having terrible turmoil in the church. And you may have been here to hear me talk about this. They said he had 5 trustees. He's got about 50 members in his church. He's got 5 trustees. Those are not deacons. Those are trustees. They're the businessmen. Now, they were having problems over deciding what contractor they were going to pick to fix a broken window. And they had about $1,000 already budgeted to make repairs, unexpected repairs. And so they had decided, they got together, they had a vote, and they decided, let's fix the window. Okay, so somebody made the motion, we fixed the window, and then they voted on it, and they decided to fix the window, and then they assigned it to the trustees to decide which contractor to pick. And they were having a big division over this. Now, we laugh about that, but I tell you what, people's hearts get broken over stuff like that. Pastors get discouraged, people leave churches, the work of the devil is done, and people don't get saved as a result of it. And he said, what am I going to do? How am I going to help these guys? I said, I'll tell you what, I wouldn't try to help them come to a decision on that matter. If they believe, and you have allowed them to believe, that they have nothing better to do than that, then let them decide what they're going to do and let them get the window fixed. And you get busy studying and teaching your people so that they'll understand how to get things done somewhere down in the future. Okay? But don't try to stop. Don't have a crisis over this one. You know, don't go in and take your stand over who's going to fix that window. You know, stick a piece of cardboard in the thing and get in your study and feed those people so they know how to get that stuff fixed in the future. Remember what we said last week? The pastor exerts his leadership in what way? Teaching. How do the deacons exert their leadership? Serving. How do the people exert their leadership? Same way. Okay? Same way. Serving and teaching those that they have the opportunity to teach. Does anybody get to say, because I have the following qualifications, therefore I get my way? That's not right. What group of people within our society and community is it that says, I get my way? Children. Little immature children. That's exactly right. And spiritual children do too. You know, I want my way. You know, you've heard Les Olola's illustration about that. You see it all the time. You go back here in the nursery or, you know, have your kids over to play with somebody else's kids or my kids, and you'll hear it in a few minutes in there. One little kid's playing with a toy, and this other little kid picks up another toy, and all of a sudden he doesn't want him to have that toy, and here he'll go, my truck, you know. And there you go. And 35 years later, they're married and standing in front of a judge someplace, and the guy's saying, my truck, you know. Isn't that right? And, you know, they're splitting up the property because they can't get along. And the maturity level hadn't really changed a great deal. And so we're fussing over those kinds of things. Now, that kind of thing right there does not glorify the Lord. And we've got far too many things to do. One of the things I told Dave last week, this fellow I was talking with, I said, brother, listen, get your people to a place and get yourself to the place where if they realize what we're really here to do in this earth and they're busy doing what they're supposed to be doing, they're not going to have time to be fussing about that kind of stuff anyway. You see, that'll be a minor thing. So, the way we do that here, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on when we get to finances and so on, we take most of our church votes when we present the budget. Everything that's included in the budget, that's the time when we're going to decide whether we're going to do it or not. Okay? That's how when we decide whether we're going to support the missionaries. If, you know, if we got this budget right here, and there's line item someplace, somebody's got a piece of paper. If there's a figure in that budget on a particular category that says $15,000, there is a list someplace of things that are named with prices beside them, and the total is $15,000. And if you want to see that list, you can. All you have to do is ask Sam Smith, okay? But when we approve the budget, and that $15,000 is part of the whole million or whatever it is, all the things that are on that list, we just agreed to buy, okay? Now, we might not. That's why we've employed a financial secretary, and we've appointed a business manager to make sure that when it comes time to buy that thing, that we've got the best deal, that we're in good stewardship, that we've shopped around, that we actually have the money, okay? And that when we buy the thing, we take proper care of it and we pay the bill on time. Now, when you multiply that out times tens of thousands of things during the year, literally that many, you know, that's a lot of stuff. And we can't be having business meetings on every one of those kinds of things. And have you ever noticed how business meetings tend to, in every organization, whether you're talking about a company, whether you're talking about a church, whether you're talking about a family, they tend to take longer to make decisions on which more people have input. I mean, you can have a meeting of the South Carolina Nuclear Regulation Commission and get all those people together and decide whether they're going to open up the Barnwell facility. And you know how many people there are in the state that are qualified to participate in that discussion? About two. Okay, so they can have that business finished. I mean, let's say they got three things on the agenda. Whether they're going to open up the Barnwell facility, whether they're going to build a bicycle shed for the secretarial pool, or what kind of coffee they're going to use for the next meeting. Which one of those decisions do you think is going to take the longest? Sure it will. Why? Because everybody's got an opinion on that one. Sure it will. And everybody who's ever nailed a nail will have some input on that second one. But there's only going to be one or two people that can make that other decision. You see? So when they get ready to make a decision, a lot of times the really serious ones are important ones. Most folks sit back and think, you know, and then somebody will say, well, I think we ought to do this. And everybody will say, okay. But then when we get down, you know, that's why you got to be so careful when you're talking about building a building, because everybody's built a doghouse or framed a wall or, you know, hit their thumb with. And if you're not careful, you know, if you bring in that level of discussion, well, it'll take forever, you see. So I'm not saying that it's not important for us to participate, but we need to understand that that sometimes just because we have something to say doesn't necessarily mean we ought to say it. By the same token, if we do have something to say, we ought not to sit back and say, well, they don't care what I think, you see. So there needs to be a balance. So there are practical things we've got to do. Church clerk, of course, is the person who keeps the records. The church treasurer is the person who maintains the money. The trustees, we really don't have trustees here. Now, some states, you have to have them. But South Carolina doesn't require them right now. The state of South Carolina does not require the office of trustee. If in the future the church is required to fill this office, the pastor shall become the trustees. It shall be the duty of the trustees to represent the church in certain legal matters as required by law and to hold in trust the property of the church. Trustees, basically, are fellows who sign on the line who then become not only liable in the name of the corporation, but personally liable, as I understand, for the things that they are committing themselves to. It depends on the laws of the state. That's pretty serious business. It really is. I mean, for example, if I sign on some church business and I know that we make a big mistake and I'm not only going to get the church in trouble, but everything that I own is on the line too, you know, I'm going to be a little more careful about that. So I can understand how when you get a situation where you have to have trustees, those fellows are going to tend to be a little bit more careful because they're not just dealing with church business, they're dealing with their own business, you see, and that is serious. Yes, sir.
Doesn't the corporation protect that individual?
It depends on the state laws. Usually, yes, but in some situations where you have trustees, the trustees are personally liable. Now, that's not true in South Carolina. Thank the Lord for that. But on the other hand, there are some states. Does anybody have any input on that? Does anybody know of a state where that's true? Yes, sir.
Colorado,
where if you have somebody where they actually sign a note, they are personally liable. And now, in some situations, there's corporate protection, but that's why they require trustees in some states to sign a bank loan or something like that. And in some states, if let's say that a church wants to take a note and borrow, I'll say, $1 million, okay? You're not going to get that $1 million unless you get enough people who have that kind of collateral totally to sign the paper and commit their personal assets and resources to that thing. And that's a serious level of commitment. Generally speaking, the corporation will protect, but there are some states where that's the case. But it's not that way in South Carolina. Concerning business meetings of the church. Now, business, you got to do business and you got to make decisions, right? All right. Business shall be handled through the pastors, trustees, deacons, employees of the church, or members as applicable to their sphere of responsibility. Now, sphere of responsibility is the operative phrase there, okay? For example, I might ask from time to time or drop a little hint or two that I'm interested in knowing what you're interested in knowing as far as the preaching is concerned, okay? But we won't be having any business meetings about that, okay, to decide what I'm going to preach on next Sunday. Why? Because we can't discern God's will that way. We can't get together in committee and somebody says, well, I'd like for you to preach on this and I'd like for you to preach on that. And, you know, I mean, that'd just be confusion. And so you can't do that. This morning, as we started reading Deuteronomy, I was really impressed as I listened to Moses, the beginning of his sermon there. By the way, Deuteronomy is basically Moses' sermon on the border of the promised land. It was a long sermon too. But, you know, we've been reading all through so far, again, this year and before, how the people were following the Lord or rebelling against the Lord. But it's not until you get to Deuteronomy that you start to realize that they were either following or rebelling against Moses too. They gave Moses a lot of grief. But now Moses always says that they weren't rebelling against him, they were rebelling against the Lord. But on a practical level, they were giving Moses an awful lot of grief. And I wonder how those little kids felt when they got around Moses. You know, when you see somebody who's well-known and influential and you don't get to see him very often, somebody who holds high rank or something like that in something that you admire, and you get around that person, don't you sort of stand in awe of a person like that? I wonder if that's how they felt about Moses. And yet they didn't mind speaking against him. You see, we don't either, you see. So there's some interesting things to think about as we read through that. But the sphere of responsibility determines how we conduct our business. There are some things that the pastors just need to take care of. There are other things that if we had trustees, then of course they'd need to take care of. Some things are the deacons' responsibilities. Some belong to the employees of the church. And the employees ought to just go ahead and take care of those kinds of things, you see. And then there are other responsibilities that belong to the members. And everybody has his sphere of responsibility. His authority, therefore, comes with his responsibility. Remember that principle? The authority belongs to the responsibility. It doesn't belong to the person. Authority always comes with responsibility. If you have a responsibility, you need to have the authority to fulfill that responsibility. Right? You don't need any more authority than is necessary to fulfill that responsibility, but you must have enough authority to fulfill that responsibility. Everybody knows the frustration of feeling like you have a responsibility, but you don't have the authority to carry it out. Isn't that right? If anybody's ever been in the military, you know how frustrating that is. They'll give you a job to do, and then they won't give you the equipment to do it with or the right to go get the equipment. And so there are these two levels that take place. There's this official level, and then there's this subliminal, clandestine you know, get the part from your buddy level. Okay, if you've got to get your airplane fixed, you know, and you can't get the part that you need through the system, well, then there's this other system down here where we're all sneaking around the system itself. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, and every Air Force mechanic has got enough parts in his toolbox to fix his plane, you see. That's illegal. Because if you keep the parts in your toolbox, then the Air Force doesn't know how much stuff it has. That's the way we are. It's probably that way in every other branch of service and probably a lot of the companies you work with, okay? And then they always come in and have an inspection. We have to go take all that stuff and hide it because they want to see if we had it, you see. Isn't that right? Because, you know, if you've got to change a bulb and a certain thing in your cockpit, you don't want to go fill out 6 forms and stand in line for 45 minutes and then tell the guy, have the guy tell you it's back-ordered. See? And then you come out and the sergeant chews you out because your plane's not ready. See? So the next time you see one, you do what we call in the military, you put a 5-finger discount on it. Okay? Which means you get it and you put it in your toolbox. So if you ever need another one, you got it. Okay? Now that kind of thing right there happens a lot in a lot of ways of life. And the reason it happens is because sometimes people feel like they're held responsible to do something, but they're not given the authority to get it done. That's very frustrating. Let's suppose, for example, that somebody gives you a task, and then they're always breathing down your neck about how you're doing it. You see, that's frustrating, isn't it? That's an interesting principle there for child rearing. You know, I remember the first time I built a model with Johnny. Notice what I just said. First time I built the model, okay? It was a beautiful model. I made it look like the real thing, but he didn't have very much fun, and he didn't learn very much. And I realized what I was doing, and after a while, I started letting him build the models. Now, at first, they didn't look real good, but they got better, and he had a lot more fun, and he learned some things, and he enjoyed himself, you see. I got to tell you a story on Joseph. Now, don't you tell him I told you this. Last night, I came in, and he's in the kitchen. Now, he's in the first place, he's been out playing Army all day. He's got his cami fatigues on and his little boots, and he's got his face all blackened. You know, he's got his little plastic gun and all this kind of stuff. He's been out, you know, dodging and weaving all through the trees and the mud there in the new property. And playing Army with the Burrow kids. And so he's at the house now, and my wife's out of town, and so he wanted to make a little treat for her. So he has all the stuff there on the counter. And he read this recipe on the side of these Cocoa Puffs. Okay? Boy, now there's a nutritious product. But he had these things out here, this, you know, these chocolate-covered sugar bombs or whatever it is that Calvin calls them. Okay, he's got these things out there. And then he's got the bowl. He's got the peanut butter and the sugar and the corn syrup. And there's this recipe on the side. And it lists all the ingredients up here, and then it gives the directions about how to put them together. So Joe, you know, good cook that he is, he starts at the top of the list, and when he reads an ingredient, he puts it in a bowl. He reads another ingredient, he puts that in a bowl. So he's got the Cocoa Puffs in there. He's got 3/4 of a cup of peanut butter. He's got the corn syrup. He's got some sugar. And he says, Dad, I don't have any marshmallows. He said, could we go get some marshmallows? I said, well, what else you got on there? And he said, well, it's some chocolate chips. We need some of those. And he said, I think we got some of those, though. I said, okay, well, check and see what else you need so that if we're going to go get this stuff, we don't have to make 2 or 3 trips. So he said, okay. So about 5 minutes later, he comes in. He says, I don't believe this. I said, what's the problem? He says, you're supposed to mix all this other stuff up and cook it before you put it in the bowl. He says, do you think if I just put it all in there and then cooked it, it would be okay? I said, I don't think so, Joe. I don't think it would work. And so, anyway, he's got all this stuff in here. Now, he's wasted some things, right? And so I'm thinking, what are we going to do with this? He says, well, Dad, this is never going to work. He says, what are we going to do with this? I said, I don't know. You think Bo wants it? And he said, I don't know. It might make him sick. And so, you know, now look, what I'm saying is I could have got really upset over the fact that he wasted probably $1 worth of stuff, maybe $2 worth of stuff, okay, and made a little bit of a mess. Or I could have really let him learn something and had as much fun with him through learning that experience as we would have had if he actually got those things made and we'd been able to eat them, which we didn't need to anyway, okay? So he said, what am I going to do with this, Dad? And I said, well, I don't know, Joe. I don't think I'll feed the dog. Probably make him sick. And I said, I sure don't want any oat, no offense. And he says, yeah, I don't either. And so he says, do you think we could start over and maybe I could, you know, like read all this the first time? And I said, well, that'd be all right. And he said, I'd really like to make these for Mom. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what you do. You stand here and you get this stuff down the disposer and you make sure it's all cleaned up and you clean all these things up and you clean the mess up, okay? And then we'll talk about whether we're going to get some more ingredients so you can make these for Mom. So he cleaned the whole mess up and he got everything all taken care of and all put away. And he came in and then he made this statement. Boy, this is one for the book. He said like that. And so, you know, we got these experiences like this that we talk about. But I thought, you know, now that ended up turned out to be a learning experience for him. He didn't learn what he thought he was going to learn. Okay? And he did not get the joy, the exact joy, that he thought he was going to get. But it didn't have to be some big painful conflict either, you see, because he had taken on some authority that I didn't give to him, okay? But he also accepted the responsibility. Now, by the same token, if I had given him a responsibility, I would have to give him the authority. There's an important principle to remember there. If somebody takes a responsibility, give them the authority. If somebody wants the authority, give them the responsibility. You see? That's how those two things go together. That's an extremely important principle that will really help us there. Okay, so, sphere of responsibility. Voting members shall be at least 18 years old. Why? Sounded like a good number, okay? I can't think of any particular reason. I know some people think the age of accountability is 12. And then when you get to be 12, at that point you need to be saved. And they base that on the fact that Jesus was 12 when he went to the temple. Well, that's arbitrary, and so is 18. But it's when you're legally an adult, and we thought, well, we'll just use that. All business will be handled through prayer and humility of spirit. When major decisions are being made, such as those involving budget approval, mission support, major expenditures, election of officers, adoption or rescission of standing resolutions, and calling or dismissing the senior pastor and associates. I think those are major decisions, don't you? Why? Why are they major decisions? Yeah, they affect everybody. They affect everybody. They affect a lot of people. They affect money. They affect others. They have an effect on a lot of folks. Therefore, they're major decisions. When those kinds of things are being discussed, then the pastor shall call a general business meeting. The dates and times of all business meetings shall be announced in a regular service preceding the business meeting. Now, if it's something that we got to deal with, we ought to let folks know we're going to be doing this. So if we got something we got to deal with tonight, we'll try to tell you this morning. Now, look, tonight we're going to be doing so-and-so. And if you want to participate in that, you ought to be here is the implication. Now, if you're willing to trust the folks who are here to make the decision, no problem. But if you want to have a part in it and you feel like you have some valuable input, you need to know ahead of time what's going to happen so that you can be there. You see? And that's important. You don't want somebody springing this on you or calling some kind of a meeting and, you know, making sure you're not there, you know, so they can have the decision in your absence and that sort of thing. And those kinds of things do happen, by the way, in churches. You know, there's all kinds of political maneuvering like that. Can you imagine what kind of fellowship you could have in an environment like that? What kind of love and compassion there could be in an environment where somebody was always trying to outmaneuver somebody else? But they call a business meeting and announce ahead of time, 20% of all voting members shall constitute a quorum for the transaction of business. Why is that?
Can a quorum control the entire corporation?
A quorum can conduct business. Now, you know what the average person, the average situation does? I learned this from a wise man who had planted a lot of churches. He said, keep your quorum small. I didn't agree with him for a long time. I thought, that doesn't make sense. If you don't have enough of your people, how are you going to have majority rule? He said, if you don't keep your quorum small, you'll always have minority rule. I said, well, I don't understand that. He said, because if you require too many people to conduct business, a few uncooperative people can always get their way. For example, if you have to have 80% of the people here, all you need is 21% staying away, and you can't do anything. You see? Now think about it. If you make your quorum too big, then you don't have a sense of commitment or cooperation, then you can't get anything done. So, we may have 20% may be a little extreme, but at the same time, I said, what do you recommend? He said, I'd go with 20%. I said, okay, all right. I said, has this worked elsewhere? He said, yeah, we've done it in a lot of churches. This particular man had been involved in the planting of 80 churches. And this was one of the things he always suggested. Why? Well, suppose, for example, that you've got some simple thing you need to take care of. And, you know, now the point there is not that 20 people can control a corporation, but that any 20% of the people should be so committed that they'll be able to discern the Lord's will. There are other ways that you protect yourself against the tyranny of the 20, okay? And that's by keeping your membership roles clean and making sure that everybody who's a member is committed, and by disciplining disobedience and things like that. You see, if you tolerate a lot of disobedience, there's no way in the world to set up a governmental structure in a church or a family or a country or anything else where you can prevent the damage that carnal, selfish people can do. The best thing to do is to deal with carnality and to deal with selfishness and to deal with sin and see that the people who are involved have a sense of discipline. Now, again, you're not going to prevent every problem, but this is the recommendation that we've used for a lot of years, and it seems to work very well. Parliamentary procedure. Now, listen, anytime you have a question or a comment, please raise your hand or interrupt or, you know, we'll call a vote or something here if you want to, okay? But make sure you understand and that you're clear on these things, okay? Parliamentary procedure not mentioned in this Constitution shall be governed by the current edition of Robert's Rules of Order. I heard a well-known preacher make a comment one time in a business meeting, and he was kind of half-joking. This particular preacher, don't try to guess who I'm talking about, okay? Because I'm cloaking it on purpose. But this particular preacher really makes a big issue out of pastoral authority. But whenever he wants to get his way, he always talks about congregational rule. So what he does is, by the force of his personality, he always has a majority agreeing with him. So when he wants to do something, he'll hold a vote and get a majority. And then, if anybody doesn't like it, he blames it on the people. You see what I'm saying? But whose decision was it really? It was his and the force of his personality. And I heard him make a comment one time when he was talking about how, you know, if we believe that we ought to do something, we're just going to go ahead and do it. And somebody says, yeah, but now Robert's rules are. He said, Mr. Roberts isn't here. Right in the meeting. You know, and I heard that and I thought, yeah, that's right. You know, and I made that crack one time and I thought, and this fellow that helped me put this constitution together, he says, you know, you ought never say that. He said, Mr. Roberts ought to be here. That's why you use that. Parliamentary procedure is wise procedure. You know what it says about discussion? You know why division occurs usually in business meetings? Because you can get a half a dozen people who are against something who can sway a vote when everybody else in the congregation is for it if you don't follow parliamentary procedure. Here's how parliamentary procedure says a discussion will take place. A motion comes on the floor. And by the way, it's not technically correct to say I make a motion. Did you know that? That's not good grammar. What you're supposed to say is I move. But we're not going to worry about that, okay? Just so you'll know. Somebody says, I move, and you got a motion on the floor. Then you get a second. If you don't get a second, the discussion never starts, okay? You have to have a second. Once you get a motion and then a second, then the discussion can start. Whether somebody speaks in favor of the proposal or against the proposal, what does the second person that speaks have to do? Give the opposite view. You cannot have six proponents or six opponents of a motion speak in succession. Now, yeah, most folks don't know that. And the reason that that's important is because that's how you find out what the issues are. And that's wise, isn't it? Let's suppose, for example, that you got six bold people who agree but with each other but disagree with everybody else. And those six vocal people get up, boom, 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 in order and all speak their mind on this particular issue. At that point, if you were to take the vote after those six people got done speaking, what do you think the vote would be? Probably what they'd been saying. You see? But if one person says, well, I'm against it for this reason, and another, all right, now is there any support for the motion? Now, this is where the moderator has to be careful. Because if somebody gets up and says, well, I'd like to speak against the motion, or they find out after they're speaking that they're speaking against the motion, at that point, the moderator of the meeting has to say, point of order, excuse me, we need to have a statement in favor at this point. Do we have any support? Is there any supporting statement? Now, people can get hot if they don't realize that you're following parliamentary procedure. And a lot of times people, and I'll tell you what, every one of us in here have been in meetings where this wasn't done. Right? Yes.
Preside. Right. And if he wants to, he has to step down.
Right. If he wants to express an opinion on the thing, he has to give the chair to somebody else. Okay? He's not supposed to be expressing an opinion. Now, he can clarify, and he can question, and he can restate.
But I've seen pastors just get up and
sure.
They're presiding, and yet
right.
They're telling their point.
That's exactly right. Have you noticed that when we're conducting things with the building committee and the finance committee particularly, that I don't usually preside? Now, the Constitution says I am to preside at all the meetings. But I don't usually stand in the pulpit and conduct the business. Now, if I feel a need to, I'll step in. Okay? Or I'll make a comment. Do you know why that is? Does anybody have any idea why that is? Why I do that? Do you think I have a forceful personality? Okay. The reason that I don't do that is because I have done it in the past. That's exactly right. And I'll tell you what. I think you can conduct your business, the business of this church, far more effectively without me in that pulpit. The pulpit tends to be a rather threatening presence to a lot of people. It really does. And frankly, I just do not dilute my identity up there. Okay? When I get in that pulpit, you're expecting me to thunder forth the truth, right? Okay? And if all of a sudden I've been doing that for a while, and then we get up and we get ready to have a business meeting, it's extremely difficult, not only for you, hey, it's difficult for me to change gears. Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong. I think that a pastor who can preside, and there are plenty of situations in which I do, okay, here. But as a general rule, if we've got somebody who has studied this thing and analyzed it and looked it through and they have the details and the answers, what? Sam Smith can handle that a whole lot better than I can handle it. So let's let him handle it. And when it comes to the building program, let's let Dr. Harris get up there and explain that to us and provide that leadership for us. Now, that doesn't mean it is wrong for me to do that. And it doesn't mean that I'm trying to hide something. But I think that's one of the ways that you delegate leadership, and that's one of the ways that you disciple people. Okay? I really do. So that's I'm content to do that. And at the same time, if yes, sir.
It's that very thing.
Yeah.
You got two big plug in.
Right.
Small property to me, but
that's right.
Take care of them.
That's right. That's exactly right. You have to be able to accomplish what you're responsible for. And when your responsibilities get to a certain point, you have to give some of those responsibilities away. And for my purposes, it works better for me, and I think for the whole church, if I don't necessarily preside over everything that takes place in the church. I think that communicates the idea that there are other capable people here who can help make the decisions and provide leadership and things like that. And it also helps to establish the leadership of these other people in your minds, and that you see who they are and that kind of thing. I'm content with that. I hope you are. If you ever have a problem about it, talk to us about it. And there are times that at the same time, you got to understand, if we have somebody get selected to be put in a particular position, and with that position comes presiding over that particular committee's business or something like that, when that person is new in that position, we need to be gracious. I try to be gracious, you know, and let a person sometimes, if I may say so, kind of stumble through a business meeting or two. Well, you need to be willing to do that just like I'm willing to do it, okay? And if you'll be gracious and if you'll be kind to a person and realize that, you know, they may be a little nervous. I forget the fact that sometimes when people stand up here in front of the whole group, they get a little nervous. You know, because I don't usually get nervous. It's my job to make you nervous. Okay? But, you see, so I don't feel that way, generally, because I've done it so much. But so on the other hand, you may have a responsibility, and you may get up here and all of a sudden get all flustered, you know. So we need to be kind and gracious to a person like that. And I'm telling you, it can be real intimidating, especially when somebody asks you a question, and you don't know the answer. You know, there are some people who in that particular situation just go ahead and lie. I won't call any names, but You can see him on the news from time to time. Concerning dissolution of the corporation and liquidation of property. Yes, sir. Yeah, Quorum. We haven't established a procedure about the amount or the number or the percentage of participants that establish a quorum for business. But there is a principle, even though there's no procedure. The principle is, since committees are so much smaller, and you have, let's say you had four people involved, well, 20% would be less than one, you know, so a person could be double-minded and still make a decision, okay? But so, you know, 20% would be less than one. But on the other hand, there's the principle of accountability. And since there's a principle of accountability, no one person ought to be making a decision. Now, for example, sometimes we have decisions that we have to make. You know, there have been hundreds, probably thousands of decisions that the building committee and the finance subcommittee of the building committee have had to make about this building program. And sometimes it's tough to just get everybody together. And decisions have to be made, and they have to be made now. But even still, the principle of accountability says that you maintain your integrity by contacting somebody ahead of time to at least inform them of your decision or discuss your decision with them or at least to establish some accountability so that at the next point when we have a regular meeting, there's going to be an accounting. We're going to deal with this. We do that all the time. For example, if I have to do something and I feel like I have the authority to do it, and I have the authority to do it concerning finances or something like that, I'm still not going to go ahead and do it unless I talk to Sam. Why? Because I want him to respect me. That's why. I don't want him to feel like that I am going to be upsetting the apple cart. So if we got to make a decision, I'll try to get a hold of Sam. I'll call him on his beeper or something like that. Say, hey, call me. And then he'll call me back and I'll say, look, I feel like we got to do the following. What do you think? And it's not a question of my having to get his permission or him having to get my permission. That's accountability. And if we don't maintain that accountability, then we'll lose respect for each other. And you lose respect for us. So in a sense, accountability, in my thinking, accountability is a much higher principle than authority. It really is. You see? Because if somebody has authority over you and you're not accountable to them, then you'll find ways to trick them. You see, but if you're really accountable, you'll always be transparent. Yes, sir. Well, it depends on the business. Usually, we ought to try to announce it the week ahead of time. But depending on what it is, if something comes up that we've got to move, we may announce it in the morning and have it in the evening. I don't know that there would ever be a case, there may have been, I don't want to speak absolutely, where we would say we're going to have a meeting after this service. Have we ever done that? I think we felt like we had to sometimes, but we've always tried to avoid it because it seems deceptive and like railroading and those kinds of things. But on other procedures, like the budget, we know right now when the budget meeting is going to be this year. And we also know right now when it's going to be next year because it's always at the same time, sometime in the middle of the end of June, so we can put the new budget into effect the 1st of July. So certain routine things are scheduled like that. Does that answer your question? Right. Right. And that's a good procedure, and that may work. There's another thing that we got to do. Now, remember this. According to this Constitution, who has the authority to call a business meeting? I'm hearing two or three different things. According to the Constitution, who calls the business meeting? The pastors call the business meeting. The pastors have to call the business meeting, okay? Now, suppose, for example, that the pastors don't want to call a business meeting, and they refuse, and the people want a business meeting anyway. What can they do?
Get rid of the pastor.
If the pastor will not serve, take him off the board and put the board on him, as the song says. Okay. But that's what you do. Okay. So again, if he's not leading, if he's not serving, get somebody who will. You see? The one thing that the congregation can do to or for or with the pastor here is send him walking, okay? But you can't control him. Now, I really think that's a better plan. That's tougher. It is harder to confront a pastor and say, you're out of here, than it is to say, now, you know, pastor, no offense here, I'm going to use your illustration, though. Now, you know, pastor, you didn't give us 10 days. You see? Because those kinds of procedures there do not generally foster accountability. They foster rigid conformity to authority. And that's my thinking on it anyway, and that's how it works. However, that system that you have, if that's what everybody's agreed on and that's what they want to do, that can work just as well as any other system if everybody is agreeable to those procedures. Okay? So that's where I say I think there's some latitude for a variety of systems. But it's far more important that we maintain spiritual accountability with each other, especially in a system like this, because there is the possibility of abuse if we don't keep our hearts right. Okay? Boy, the time's gone. This section here, we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about that, but I just want you to look over it. Concerning the authority to dissolve, disposition of assets, and concerning selection of recipient of assets. Basically, that is required in a corporate document in order to be a nonprofit corporation. Nobody can get any personal benefit. Let's suppose, for example, that we got $500,000 or let's say $250,000 in the bank, and we've got $3-4 million worth of property, and there's about 200 of us left because we've driven everybody else off, and there's no sense in meeting anymore. So we say, we don't want to do this anymore. Let's take all the money and divide it by 200, and let's sell the property and split that. Okay? And let's say we do that. What's the next thing that happens? Somebody goes to jail. That's the next thing that happens, okay? Whoever thought that up and permitted that is going to jail. Why? Because that's illegal, okay? Because you're no longer a nonprofit corporation. You can't do that. One of the ways that you maintain your nonprofit corporation status is nobody in the thing can profit from it, okay? And if you start dividing up the property and you start dividing up the money and that kind of thing, well, then you're not operating legally. So what you have to do is you have to demonstrate what you're going to do with the property if you cease to exist. Now, I got to tell you, I have read a lot of church constitutions. I have never, ever seen anything about dissolution of property. Personally, there may be some. I've never seen anything about dissolution of property in another church constitution anywhere. And yet, most of the churches I know of are corporations. How did they get incorporated without putting that in there? I've never figured it out.
Money.
Took it and hit the road. Yeah. Hey, that happens.
Yeah.
Sure it happens. Happens a lot. Well, what we have tried to do here is we've set it up in such a way that if we ever dissolve this corporation, if there is any surviving ministry or any related ministry, now can anybody think of another related ministry here that would be a natural recipient of our assets if this church were to ever dissolve? Hidden Treasure Christian School. Hand it over and go to church someplace else. I mean, if it ever got to the place where, you know, maybe some problem in our government or in our society or something like that where, you know, we just have to fold this thing up and I go get a job and you go to church somewhere else and all this kind of thing. What are we going to do with this property? Well, we'll give it to school. Let's suppose the school doesn't exist. Well, then, can anybody else think of another? Give it to Spanish church. Right. Suppose Spanish church doesn't exist. Give it to the Japanese church. All right. Or divide it up and send it to the missionaries or something. That's what we have. Yes, sir. Sure. Yeah. Or how have we decided? And there's a procedure set up to decide how those assets would be divided. But that's important. If you ever have a nonprofit corporation, you have to have a procedure established in order to do that. Okay, next week we'll get into this thing on concerning employees of the church. And there's some very interesting statements in here about complaining. Okay? So I recommend that you read that. And if you don't have a copy of it, get it. Because we have some definite procedures established for how to complain and what happens to you if you complain differently. Okay? All right. That's important. I'll tell you where I got this too next week. Okay? Father, thank you for this time. Help us now as we have our time of fellowship and prepare for the morning service, that our hearts would be attuned to your will. In Jesus' name, amen.